for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday, the White House turned down TransCanada's application for the Keystone XL pipeline. Republicans had imposed a February 21st deadline for the decision, a deadline the administration claimed did not allow for sufficient environmental review. Joining me to talk about the decision, Stephen Mufson of The Washington Post, Matthew Cook of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and Sarah Ladislaw of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Joining us by phone from Ripton, Vermont, Bill McKibben. He's scholar in residence at Middlebury College. I know many of you have strong feelings about the decision. I'll look forward to hearing from you throughout the hour. And good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
And to you, Stephen Mufson. President Obama said he was not going to bow to political pressure. He also said this was not a judgment on the merits. How did he make his decision?
Well, I think he made this decision by saying that there wasn't enough time to go through all the steps that the State Department was supposed to go through in evaluating the pipeline. Of course, proponents say they've been thinking about this for 3 years already, but still, the State Department said it didn't have enough time, and particularly for a new route through Nebraska, which TransCanada has yet to submit an exact plan for.
Explain why the State Department was the one making the decision here.
State's making this decision because the pipeline crosses an international border, and that puts it in state's hands. And state's done this before, but it's not its particular specialty, but it is its responsibility.
Stephen Mufson, he's energy correspondent for The Washington Post. Turning to you, Sarah Ladislaw, explain the purpose of the pipeline and the route that was actually proposed.
It was a 1,700-mile long pipeline that essentially connects the oil sands, which is a vast sort of oil resource in Alberta, Canada, and to bring it down into the mid-continent where there's existing infrastructure, pipeline infrastructure, but then also connect from Cushing, Oklahoma, down into Texas. And so the pipeline actually has sort of a dual purpose. The first is to sort of de-bottleneck the mid-continent where we have a lot of refining capacity, but we have a glut of excess crude oil capacity that has, you know, persisted there for the last couple of years. So the lower part of that pipeline is actually designed to bring some of that excess oil capacity in the mid-continent down to the Gulf Coast and move it out through those markets and get it down to those refineries. But it's also to bring increasing volumes of Canadian oil sands into the United States and bring them down to the Gulf Coast, where refineries are actually well-suited to be able to produce that crude into product.
Sarah Ladislaw, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Matthew Cook, why did Republicans impose a February 21 deadline on this?
Well, from what the comments that they've made and from what the debate during when the legislation was passed as part of the Payroll Extension Act that went through right before Christmas, you know, they made it clear that they were unhappy with the progress being made by the administration on permitting this project. And as Stephen mentioned, you know, there's been a 3-year period of review and some extensive environmental review. And, you know, they just felt that had been a long enough time and they wanted to see the project permitted and give a little more certainty to the industry.
Matthew Cook of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And turning to you, Bill McKibben, I know you've been very involved with this issue. Why did the Obama administration feel that there had to be further studies on this when 3 years have gone by?
Well, in the first place, 3 years really haven't gone by, as everybody's by now, as Steve and his colleagues at the Post and others have made clear. there was at best a cursory beginnings of a review by the State Department. When people really started to focus on this year, all kinds of other issues came up that they didn't even consider. And the most important, of course, came from the federal government's chief climatologist, Jim Hansen at NASA. What he said was that if we heavily tap those Canadian tar sands, of which this Keystone Pipeline is one beginning way of heavily tapping them, it would be essentially game over for the climate. That's why this turned into a huge political uproar. It's why there were more public comments on this energy project than any in American history. And it's why it so scared the big oil industry. Look, I'm no knee-jerk fan of partisan of the president. I was arrested outside his house in August. But he deserves real credit for what he did yesterday. He didn't just do the right thing, he did the brave thing. In the face of bald political threats, a week ago, the head of the American Petroleum Institute said there would be, quote, huge political consequences if he didn't back down. And, of course, you know, the man has the money to carry out those kind of threats. In the face of all that, Barack Obama stood up, and if the knock on him has been that he's too, you know, too rolls over too easily, he's too kind, he's always trying to make friends, not the case here. This is really the high water mark of his relationship with the environmental community, and it's one of the very few days, having written the first book about global warming 23 years ago, it's one of the very few days in those 20 years when scientists were left smiling and big oil left scowling. I've been hearing from climate scientists for the last 24 hours, and they kept saying the same thing. Our faith in this process is a little restored in the idea that government might someday come to grips with the biggest problem that we've ever faced.
Bill McKibben, he's scholar in residence at Middlebury College. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Sarah, back to you. Give us a sense of the current pipeline organization throughout this country, the landscape.
Well, I think that it's an interesting time to be asking that question, because not only is this an issue of whether or not we try and bring in more Canadian oil sands, a resource that is oftentimes thought of as something within the purview of the U.S., but is actually Canadian, which the Canadians would like to remind us from time to time. But we also have a great deal of new unconventional oil and gas production in this country that, you know, is actually coming on quite quickly. And so there will be a time over the next several years where the production of these new resources were actually quite commercial to produce, require and will require not only a refiguring of some of the pipeline infrastructure in this country that has been slated to produce for and transport product and crude oil in a certain direction, mostly into the Midwest to be refined there and then shipped out to other regions, but to sort of reconfigure how that infrastructure exists, whether or not, you know, the heavy oil refineries are still going to exist in the Gulf of Mexico, whereas the light, you know, lighter refineries will exist in other regions of the country. So there's actually going to be a fair amount of change and quite dynamic change that goes on within sort of the North American oil, both supply distribution infrastructure and refinery infrastructure. And I think we're only starting to really understand how that's going to come, how that's going to sort of play out over the next several years, because this new sort of boom in U.S. unconventional resources is so new.
And Stephen Muffson, how does this pipeline present risks that are different from those already present?
Well, I think the main issue is that this pipeline is seen by its opponents as promoting the development of more production out of the oil sands area in Canada's Alberta province. And these oil sands, extracting oil from them is really a little bit more like strip mining than it is like drilling for oil. You're melting down these sands and getting oil out of it, and it's very energy intensive. And that's the key part of this whole issue, is that getting oil out of that area is more energy intensive and contributes more greenhouse gases that could further climate change. And
Matthew, that's what makes Cook, how do you see it?
Well, you know, certainly there's a resource that is massive and known as the second largest reserves just north of the border. And as we look at it, you know, we hope that we can that resource can be developed, and it's being developed in a much more environmentally friendly manner as technology has gotten better and as more investments gone in place up in Canada. About 20% of it is going to be recovered by mining, and about 80% is going to be recovered by a newer method that leaves a much smaller footprint called in situ. That is a smaller footprint for the place and where the mining is done, and not the mining, but the drilling is done. It's much similar to conventional drilling for oil. But in fact, the other benefit we have is that we're going to be able to import this oil from a country that has our best interests in mind, that we've been friendly with for many years and is a good, strong ally. It also gives us an opportunity to have a stable source of energy going forward. And in the future, as we look to alternatives and other sorts of energy, it helps us create that bridge that we're looking for. You know, we're going to need 21% more energy in this country, as our Energy Information Agency has said, by 2025. And we're going to need to get those resources from somewhere. Even the State Department acknowledged that while this pipeline it has some low risk, it's still less risky than importing oil from other parts in the country, over the world, I should say. And so, you know, we're looking at this as an opportunity to bring in energy. We're looking at this as an opportunity to create jobs. We have workers in this country that are looking for jobs, and this is certainly a tremendous opportunity for job benefits. So,
Matthew Cook, he's Vice President of Oil Sands and Arctic Issues at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Institute for 21st Century Energy. We'll take a short break. We'll talk further. Take your calls and emails. Stay with us. And in this hour, we're talking about the president's denial of TransCanada's application for the Keystone Pipeline. Here in the studio, Stephen Mufson, The Washington Post, Matthew Cook of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Sarah Ladislaw of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and joining us by phone, Bill McKibben, scholar in residence at Middlebury College. Here is our first email from Marilyn in Arvada, Colorado. Please describe the Ogallala Aquifer. The D.C. press seems to portray it as some obscure little spot in Nebraska. In reality, the aquifer is the largest in North America, covering nearly all of Nebraska, half of Kansas, all the Texas Panhandle, eastern New Mexico, Colorado and Wyoming, and southern South Dakota. Finding a second alternate route around this aquifer is not a minor issue. Bill McKibben.
Hey, people across the pipeline route rallied in opposition to this thing. The strongest opposition came from Nebraska, where the Republican governor and the Republican senator asked that the thing be rerouted and that the permit be denied in the fall. TransCanada has said it's going to try to rerouted around the one area, the Sand Hills of Nebraska. But as your emailer points out, that leaves an awful lot of aquifer still to cross. And there's plenty of reason. I mean, forget the climate impacts and things for a moment. Plenty of reason to be worried about this. The precursor pipeline, Keystone 1, managed to leak a dozen times in its first year. We had two big spills last year, one in the Yellowstone River and one in the Kalamazoo River, and these aren't cleaned up yet. This is, you know, the point is that for a huge variety of reasons, the time has come to stop trying to further our addiction to fossil fuel and find, you know, some new pusher for it. The time has come to end that addiction and really begin to take serious steps to go in a new path. We're not doing that so far. You know, the head of the Chamber of Commerce, Thomas Donohue, gave a speech last week in which he listed the huge volumes of natural gas and coal and oil that we should burn in this continent. I called the folks at NASA that day and asked them to add it up, and they said if you added it all up, all the things that he wants to burn just in America, it would raise the carbon concentration in the atmosphere from about 400 parts per million now to about 650. This is just exemplary of the radicalism of big oil.
All right.
And it's those of us who are, you know, in Nebraska and all around the rest of the country who are kind of the left as the odd conservatives in this fight, trying to hold on to a planet and a continent that looks something like the one we were born on, too.
All right. And one element that proponents of the Keystone Pipeline have pointed to is the number of jobs. I've heard anywhere from 2,500 to 50,000 and most temporary jobs. What are the facts, Steve Mobson?
Well, what TransCanada, the company that wants to build the pipeline, says is that this would create 20,000 job years, 13,000 for direct construction jobs, and the rest for supply chain jobs. But what they mean by job years is that if the project takes 2 years, then that's two job years. So in fact, we're really talking about 6,500 construction jobs, which of course is still a real number of jobs, but just not as many as some of the proponents make it out to be. In addition, TransCanada has already spent much of the money, if not most of the money, that it plans to spend for parts. And so the additional jobs in the future that would go to the supply chain is probably not so great.
Sarah, what about those jobs?
Yeah, I tend to be on the side of thinking that a lot of these jobs numbers are in the category of voodoo science. When you start trying to dig down into what a job year is versus a job and what could actually constitute an American job versus something that would just be economic growth for some company that, you know, maybe here or maybe there, it gets very complicated very fast. And so as sort of an energy purist, I think that there's lots of reasons to look at projects like this and the virtue of the projects like this, but then also, as Bill had, you know, rightly mentioned, some of the risks of projects like this, because it has both. And I understand that the name of the game right now is quite political and it has to do with jobs, but I think if you wanted to build this pipeline based on the jobs alone, it's probably a bit of a hard sell. And you know, I feel like once the American public sees numbers thrown around at that, you know, variety that you talked about and with all those qualifiers, it begins to mean very little very fast.
And joining us now from his office here in D.C., David Molino. He's with Labor's International Union of North America. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning.
I know your members are big supporters of the pipeline. Tell us why.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on today.
Surely.
I really appreciate it. We are big supporters of the pipeline, and we're very disappointed in the White House's decision on this. And I know that the jobs issue has been one of the most contested issues as a part of this debate. But the fact of the matter is the construction sector has been hit particularly hard by this recession. And unemployment levels in the construction sector in particular still far outpace the national unemployment unemployment averages or unemployment numbers, and creating jobs for construction workers is of paramount importance to the laborers' union.
I can certainly understand that. However, considering the wide range of numbers we've heard not only here this morning but throughout this debate, aren't you somewhat concerned about the reality of those jobs out there?
Well, first of all, for a construction worker who's otherwise sitting idle, any job is a good job, and these will be particularly good jobs. Any chance to increase the opportunity for work increases the amount of wages and benefits that our the workers have access to. And look, the nature of the construction industry, and unfortunately, Diane, you referred to it as one of the sort of pejorative terms that these jobs have been characterized as temporary. The nature of construction generally means that projects begin and they end.
Sure.
Our workers are, by their daily existence or their careers, are used to moving from project to project. And projects of this size and scope do not come along every day.
I understand. Now, one other question. You're also a citizen of this country. I wondered to what extent you and your members are concerned about climate change. Does the project give you any pause?
Well, this project doesn't give us any pause, but to that issue, the Laborers International Union of North America has been at the forefront of the climate change debate amongst unions in this country. We're supporters of comprehensive climate change legislation. We've worked very hard to see that come to fruition. We don't believe that this pipeline or stopping this pipeline is going to have an effect on the development of the oil sands. And if the oil sands are going to be developed, we believe that they should be developed in a way that produce the most amount of work opportunities on both sides of the border. By the way, we have members on both sides of the border, both in Canada and here in the United States.
Okay, I think Stephen Mufson has a question for you.
Oh, I was just going to say that even within the labor movement, while the construction workers' unions like his are in favor of the project, some other unions are opposed to it, like the transit workers, and the AFL-CIO hasn't actually taken a position on the pipeline.
All right. David, did you want to comment?
You know, we're disappointed that unions that don't have a particular stake in this issue have decided to weigh in. They've done that for their own reasons. We try to do our best to promote projects and opportunities for work for our brothers and sisters. We wish that they had not done this. The AFL-CIO has not taken a position on the project because of some of the other unions who don't have a particular stake in this matter weighing in. But again, as Stephen mentioned, the building and construction trades unions are strongly in support of this.
All right.
And we appreciate their support.
Thank you so much, David Molino of the Laborers International Union of North America. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
All right. And turning to you, Sarah Ladislaw, what impact can you project, if any, this pipeline would have, might have, on oil prices?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, with projects like this, again, it's not talking about production tomorrow. It's talking about production that would come online, you know, several years from now, except for the fact that, as I said before, the pipeline is actually two pipelines, and one of the pipelines was slated to sort of deal with some very intricate issues between the WTI pricing, which is the Mid-Continent U.S. pricing for crude, and things like Brent pricing, which is pricing for oil that's sold, you know, in sort of Asian markets. And so there are some near-term little intricacies that could read into oil markets. I think what the near-term effect on sort of global oil prices is relatively negligible. I think that there's a lot going on in the oil market right now, concern over Iran, concern over strikes in Nigeria, the impact of the European, you know, debt crisis on demand, things like that, that have a more sort of prevalent effect. The thing to keep in mind is that all energy projects are by their very nature long term. And so it's really not a question of what the impact is on today. It's a question of what the impact will be, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, which
However,
makes it hard to plan.
We've had two differing views on exactly the effect on the tar sands. Stephen Mupson, you said it was akin to strip mining, and Matthew Cook, you said that would be minimal. How do people really interpret those two views, Stephen?
I mean, about the impact on the environment.
Yeah.
Well, I think that however you describe it, I mean, I think there's an agreement that it is worse for the environment, that it produces anywhere from 5 to 15% more greenhouse gases than the average barrel of oil consumed in the United States. I think people like Bill would argue that even if this protest over the pipeline only delays production of oil sands, that that would give time to try to come up with more efficient ways to produce it. As far as whether or not that would delay things, I know there are a lot of people who say that if we don't build this pipeline, that Canada will simply export this stuff out through the West to China. But that's not so easy either, because Canada's Native Americans have a lot more clout than Americans. Building that pipeline requires permits in Canada. I think TransCanada still thinks that it's best off, and clearly in its statement yesterday, best off continuing to pursue this pipeline here in the United States, even with all the problems and delays it's had here. This is still the closest and best market for that oil, in their view, I think.
Stephen Mupson, The Washington Post, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Matthew Cook, do you want to comment?
Just to go back to that, I think it's certainly important to understand that, yes, you know, the Canadians are looking to us to as a, for the market for their product, and we're the closest country to them, and we have a demand here that needs to be met, and they see that as an opportunity. But as I mentioned earlier, you know, this is a resource that we've been around for a while, but it's only in recent years that it's become both economically and technologically feasible. And as technology gets better, we're going to continue to find ways to extract this in a more environmentally friendly manner. And, you know, we do need this resource. We do need to have it developed. And it is a benefit to American workers and to our economy going forward. As far as fuel prices are concerned, you know, I'll agree for the most part. It's hard to say how much impact it's going to have in the short term. But more, any economist will tell you, you know, more supply is not a bad thing. That there's this, when there's more supply, it helps even out some of the price spikes that might happen when there isn't stability in the world, as we've been seeing recently over in the Middle East, and those sorts of things create problems in the marketplace. And they also, but more resource nearby helps us as far as having a stable resource to import from.
Bill McKibben, do you believe that Keystone will provide an alternate route, and would an alternate route diminish some of the problems we're hearing about?
I think that probably TransCanada will try to come back and reapply, but I don't think it's going to happen easily or quickly. They'll have to go back to the beginning of this review process, and this time the review will be more transparent and more closely watched. And you know what? The same thing's happening everywhere. The Canadian government just announced a year-long pause in its environmental review of the Gateway Pipeline, exactly the thing that the Obama administration proposed would happen here and that the GOP and the Chamber of Commerce said was unacceptable.
On what grounds?
Because they've gotten a record number of public comments up there. The majority of Canadians oppose the Gateway Pipeline going west to the Pacific. More and more people on both sides of the border are waking up to the idea that quick fixes and short-term answers and finding another little bit of oil here and there is not the answer.
What do you see as the answer, Bill?
Well, I think the answer probably is to put a serious price on carbon so that we can begin the process of really making the transition away from fossil fuel. Look, the oil industry, the fossil fuel industry, is the only industry on Earth that gets to dump its waste for free. They get to use the atmosphere as an open sewer for free. And if they didn't, if we charge them, as we do every other business with, you know, putting out their waste, if we charge them the damage that they're doing, that carbon, then no one would be going near the tar sands, and we would be having a huge boom in sun and wind and all the things that people in their heart of hearts know that we need to go to and that we're just putting off going to because the oil companies are making so damn much money right now. Exxon made more money last quarter than any company in the history of money, and they use some of that money to corrupt our political process. The 234 members of the House who voted in favor of expediting the approval of this pipeline, those 234 members had taken $42 million from the fossil fuel industry.
All right. Bill McKibben of Middlebury College. He's also founder of 350.org.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
Before Social Security and other safety nets, elderly parents often bargained with their adult children for care. Family dynamics and old age caregiving in decades past. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. It's time to open the phones as we talk about the president's decision to reject, at least for now, the Keystone Pipeline application. And what's next? Let's go to Mark in Dallas, Texas. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane. I haven't had the opportunity to tell you Happy New Year, so let me
Happy
get that
New in. Year. Thank you.
Say, I wish I could share Mr. McKibben's positive outlook on this decision, and my knee-jerk reaction was that this was a nod by the Obama administration to environmentalists who represent a small portion of his disgruntled base, but that post election 2012, if he were to be reelected, that he would simply reevaluate this decision and the pipeline would proceed as according to the moneyed interests. And I wonder if he, in particular, Mr. McKibben, could comment on what could possibly prevent that or any indications to the contrary that my assessment might be wrong.
Bill.
Sure. Look, there have been a couple of things in the last little while that show the Obama administration's, I think, really starting to take some serious steps, the Mercury rule that they put out a few weeks ago was strong and good, and there'll be new rules on greenhouse gas regulations, greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, and we'll get some sense of what those will be like. And they did a good job with this regulation to increase mileage for automobiles pretty dramatically by the 2020s. Their record is far from perfect, and as I said before, you know, I mean, I spent 3 days in jail for sitting in outside the president's house. But, so I think I get to be a fairly realistic observer. I don't think there's no question that there'll be endless pressure on them to approve this pipeline and that pipeline and 100 other pipelines. I'm also pretty sure, as a realistic observer, that, that Mitt Romney would approve, if the Koch brothers told him that he was supposed to, frack Old Faithful so that it spewed propane instead of water, he'd ask him how high he wanted it to
go. All right, and I think what I want to do here is turn to Sarah, because you've written that the most disconcerting thing about the controversy over this project is what it says about our national dialogue on energy policy. Tell me about that.
Well, I think we all do have to understand it's an election year, and energy has been for the last several years a really hot topic, and it's because it touches on so many important things like jobs, like economic security, like energy security, and like the question over climate change. But the reality is that Keystone Pipeline is that. It's a pipeline, and there are lots of pipelines in this country. There's also lots of different ways of getting oil sands to market. There's lots of different ways of approaching the question of climate change. But we seem to be fixated because this is such a convenient political football. It is one of the few times that the administration has authority over citing a permit at the presidential level. That authority has been sort of handed down to the State Department. But it allows for this to be a very unique vehicle for the kind of, political controversy that makes for a lot of good headlines in an election year. And unfortunately, this administration had come in with very large aspirational goals in terms of what it wanted to do on climate change. We were having a very serious conversation about that for a few years. And now a lot of that seems to have gone away, and we seem to be focusing on this pipeline as sort of the front line or the symbol of what direction we're going to take as a country. And it doesn't actually answer those questions.
Steve Mupson.
Well, I agree, and I think that, we've been talking a lot about the pipeline, which is a supply question, but really our real problem is the demand side of it. And Bill, of course, mentioned the possibility of taxing carbon to do that, to lower that demand. But really, that's the thing. We consume an astonishing amount of oil in this country. One out of every eight or nine barrels of oil produced in the world goes into an American automobile. So even though people say that Obama doesn't have an energy policy, that's a popular thing to say. In fact, his decision to raise fuel efficiency standards for cars is arguably the most important piece of energy policy you can do. But I just also wanted to say that in reference to the idea of pricing carbon, that won't exactly solve, none of this makes the problem go away. It reduces the number of choices. We're going to have trade-offs no matter what, as long as we're consuming oil. Shell says that it uses an internal price for carbon as it is to develop projects, and that the oil sands would pass that test with a $40 price for a ton of carbon. So even if we do take measures to dampen demand, we're still going to face these trade-offs. This is why this is such an interesting issue, because it's really come to a head over this in a very graphic way. But I'm afraid that we're going to be facing these kind of trade-offs as long as we're consuming oil in large quantities.
Matthew Cook.
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in. I think there's we would be in agreement that we are still struggling over what direction our country is heading in on our energy policy. And I think you could say, regardless of which administration you've worked for over the last 20 or 30 years, or who's been president, it's been difficult to try to understand that. And in the meantime, you know, consumers and industry and you know, even folks in the environmental community, there's been a lot of confusion on and uncertainty as to what are our options, what are our opportunities, where are we going, and what is that bridge to the future? Mr. McKibben, you know, raises that, you know, this is something that's favored by the oil industry, but I would say that in the meantime, consumers, you know, perhaps are trying to figure out what their choices are going to be and what they can use going forward. If it's not gasoline or diesel or some other sort of fossil energy, what's our other options and what are our other choices? And in the meantime, those things aren't happening overnight. Those alternatives aren't being developed that quickly. And we need to have something in place to ensure that Americans have jobs, Americans can get to work, our goods and services can get to market, and that we can continue to have our economy thrive.
To Galesburg, Michigan. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
The jobs that we're talking about for building this pipeline are not typical construction jobs. They're not hammers and saws and two-by-fours. They're welders and pipe fitters. And right now in this country, welders and pipe fitters are at a rather low unemployment rate. And here in Michigan, businesses are advertising for these jobs all the time, can't get enough people to fill them. And the federal government even subsidizes their education because of projected shortages in the near future for these occupations. And further, that's my statement. My question is, aren't our oil refineries already at maximum capacity? And I'd heard that the oil that comes out of them is just going to be put on ships.
Steve.
Well, our refineries are operating at pretty close to capacity. I think this would be a benefit for the refineries in the Texas Gulf Coast because that gives them a choice of supplies. Right now they're importing some oil from Venezuela that they might be able to back out with this oil from the oil sands. And these refineries are particularly good at refining low-quality crude, so it's an advantage for them to have access to that Canadian oil. But it's not going to change the output, I think, of our refined product, really.
What about the construction jobs Chris mentions?
For the pipeline or for – well, those jobs, you know, would be created, but – you know, they'd last a couple of years.
But what he's saying is that the welders, the pipe fitters, have the lowest unemployment rate among construction workers, Sarah.
It's very hard, and it's not typically my day job to comment for, you know, on the face of labor unions. But at the same time, you know, I mean, a job is a job is a job. And so this is what makes the jobs discussion so complicated to deal with is that, well, even if they have a low unemployment rate, well, if we're an unemployed, you know, welder or someone who would work and get one of these jobs, it's a hard thing to deny. And so it makes a very politically powerful thing to talk about, but also very complicated to talk about, too.
All right. To Mishawaka, Indiana. Good morning, Dave.
Hello. My comments are mostly directed to Mr. McKibben. From what I've read from the Natural Resources Defense Council, this project in Alberta, Canada is just environmentally just horrific. What they are saying, and I want to, you know, see for confirmation to this, they are saying that they are actually destroying a forest the size of Florida to get at this stuff. And, you know, to do that, you're taking a major CO2 absorbing mechanism out of the ecosystem, which is going to greatly exacerbate climate change. In addition, as this forest decomposes, you're going to release huge amounts of carbon into the atmosphere, which is going to greatly exacerbate climate change. And you're going to kill, you know, millions of animals because they rely on this for their habitat. And as if that isn't bad enough, from what I heard, these toxic waste that's produced from getting this stuff out of the ground, they make these huge sludge ponds. It's filled with this toxic waste, and it's contaminating the water supply of native communities downstream, which is resulting in a 30% increase in their cancer rates.
Is that your understanding, Bill McKibben?
Anyone who's got Google Earth installed on their computer can go look and see what it looks like up there.
they've only gotten 3% of the oil so far, but they've already moved more earth than they moved to build the Suez Canal and the Great Wall of China and the 10 biggest dams on earth combined. They've got the largest toxic impoundments behind dams any place on earth. Now, as Mr. Cook said, they're beginning to do more of what's called this in situ mining, and that means they have to take natural gas from someplace else and pump it underground to heat the oil to make it flow enough. The basic problem is this stuff is crappy oil. It's all bound up in this sand and very difficult to get at. And the caller is absolutely right. This is the reason that indigenous people in these areas have been sounding the alarm for so long. I was up in Yellowknife, north of there, and of course the water flows north there, so these guys are downstream. A couple of months ago with Bill Erasmus, the chief of the Dene, biggest tribal band in that area, and it was just, you know, it was really powerful to hear him and his people talk about the impacts and to talk about the reasons that they've been so outspoken in trying to block this project.
All right, I want to give Matthew Cook a chance to respond.
As Mr. McKibben indicated, you know, this is certainly some projects that have been underway for a few years and have had some, you know, it's mining is has been the most common way to extract the resources closest to the top of the earth. But at the same time, they are using these newer methods. The technology is getting better. They are finding efficiencies. And this is, you know, really, as I mentioned earlier, resources have only been developed in a relatively near-term period of time. And as we always hope that Americans and other people can develop technologies that will help have us reach our goals. And if that includes getting better on climate change and getting more efficient and finding ways to extract oil in a more environmentally friendly way, we're going to use them.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Sarah, you wanted to comment.
Yeah, you know, I just thought a helpful anecdote. This has been a very interesting to debate sort of the oil sands issue from a U.S. perspective. And as Bill and others have pointed out, this is an ongoing debate that's going on in Canada as well. But there's a difference. I have an anecdote from a conference I was at not too long ago where you had representatives from Pembina, which is essentially one of the largest environmental groups in Canada that deals with the oil sands issue, and someone from the Environment Ministry in Canada, and then, you know, some oil and gas companies. And it was very interesting because they talked a lot about this concept of social license, which was recognizing the fact that, just as Bill said, there are, you know, communities that are deeply impacted and have been for years deeply impacted by what is a very intrusive industrialization process in some ways. And then there are other parts of the community that have really experienced a great deal of growth and recognize that, especially for places like Alberta, that this is a livelihood and this is a reality, that they're probably going to be producing this resource, and it's something that they think is a good thing. And the way that the discourse went is that they had this conversation about the kinds of standards that they're putting in place to improve the production, to reduce the water use, to reduce the emissions, to reduce the environmental impact. And it was a very polite sort of conversation of finding a pragmatic way forward, recognizing that there was a variety of views on the issue within society. And I think that it would sort of help remind us, you know, that this is a U.S. conversation we're having about something that's going on in Canada that, of course, has a global commons aspect to it because it does deal with climate change and things like that. However, the Canadians have found a way and are constantly working at finding a way to make peace and a way forward on this kind of a production. And it just appears that we don't necessarily have that kind of a conversation going on here.
Steve Muffson.
Well, I think Sarah makes some good points, but I'd just like to stress a little bit more that this isn't just a local decision when you're talking about environmental issues. It's not just a question of whether people will be better off in that area. It's a question of, as you say, these global commons issues and environments that we all want to share, but that we might not have as direct a stake in it as someone who actually lives there, but we still have a stake in it. And that's what makes all these environmental issues tough ones, because, you know, if you're going to decide to protect some part of the environment, that means you're going to prevent it from being developed by a certain group of people for the sake of all of us. And I think that this is typical of all these environmental issues when we're trying to protect natural resources.
Sarah.
I completely agree, and I actually think that that's a good link back to what's going on in Nebraska, in the case in Nebraska. I mean, that question of what kind of risk are you willing to take near something like the Ogallala Aquifer or something, you know, or the Sandhills or environmentally sensitive places? You know, in the last several years, we've seen a number of really startling environmental accidents related to all kinds of energy sources that really do raise the question of what kind of risks are we willing to take for the, you know, the energy that we use, provided that all energy does have some sort of risk to it, and all energy has a cost and a trade-off, as Stephen said earlier.
Or are we willing, perhaps, to put monies into alternative sources of energy? Want to thank all of you, Bill McKibben, Stephen Muffson, Matthew Cook, Sarah Ladislaw, for joining us today. A very interesting conversation. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from